Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, charity forms the heart of Pope Benedict's message for Lent this year. The Vatican released the document at a press conference Tuesday. And we take a peek inside the Vatican office responsible for interpreting the laws of the Church as it celebrates 25 years since the adoption of the new Code of Canon Law. The Vatican has released Pope Benedict's message for Lent 2008. In the message entitled, Christ Made Himself Poor for You, the Pope invites the faithful to emulate Christ's sacrifice through prayer and fasting, and places new emphasis on charity and almsgiving. The message was announced Tuesday at a Vatican press conference chaired by the President of the Pontifical Council, Cor Unum, Cardinal Paul Joseph Cordes. Emer McCarthy has more.
Presenting the document Tuesday, Cor Unum President Cardinal Cordes said at the heart of the Pope's Lenten message is a reminder, in giving, we receive.
If we look only to the sacrifice and we don't see that this sacrifice will free me and the joy of the risen Christ, then I am not a true Christian.
Cor Unum Secretary Monsignor Carol Castile said that during Lent the Council is inundated with requests for help.
The first of the nine tasks that the Pope entrusted to the Pontifical Council Cor Unum, what he calls the catechesis of charity, make people understand what charity is all about. Because there's a lot of misunderstanding also on the word itself. As you know, in the English-speaking world, there are lots of charities. But do they mean charity in the sense of the gospel? The virtue of charity, faith, hope, and charity, love, the love of God and the love of our neighbor. And that's what the Holy Father intends to say in his Lenten message.
Speaking to journalists Tuesday, Cardinal Cordes also pointed out that justice goes hand in hand with charity. He called for greater transparency among aid agencies working in the field, particularly regarding the actual percentage of donated monies which arrive at the intended destination, pointing out that in some cases over 50% is spent on no necessary administration costs. In sharp contrast, he quoted figures of Christian charities such as Caritas, the Order of Malta, and Aid to the Church in Need. According to 2006 figures, out of a total donations, these global organizations spent 9%, 7%, and 6%, respectively, on logistical expenses, the rest going completely to the projects they were destined for. Hans-Peter Ruthelin is president of Aid to the Church in Need, which raised over $81 million in 2006 to help over 5,000 projects worldwide.
One of the secrets we have to help us to calm down the administration costs is that we look to work through volunteers. We help the bishops to do their job, that they can do it. I think the biggest challenge is to never be forced something, and that is colonialism, and is not even more Christian.
Hans Ruthelin concluded by quoting Father Werenfried, founder of Aid to the Church in Need. It is essential for all aid agencies to remember that they are not only administrating the money of their benefactors, they are, above all, administrating their sacrifice and their charity. I'm Emer McCarthy.
Well, I spoke to the head of press and information at the London office of Aid to the Church in Need, John Pontifex, and asked him if he thought it was significant that the Pope would want to highlight the very special needs of Christians in the church that suffers.
I think it's become very clear already in this pontificate that Pope Benedict XVI sees as crucial to his role the support that's desperately needed for Christians in parts of the world where they do not enjoy the freedoms that we have come to know and perhaps take advantage of in this part of the world, in the West. Again and again in his statements and in the kinds of things that we've heard him say, both in his homilies and in other exhortations, he's made it clear that a line has to be drawn in the sand whereby people really do see it as being part of their Christian duty to, at the very least, to pray for those Christians who suffer for their faith, and perhaps more than that, to actually to act in a practical way in support of those who aren't as fortunate as ourselves and don't enjoy the freedoms to worship and to practice their faith freely.
In fact, if looking back over some of the other things in this pontificate, you were beginning to mention them, the Pope's encyclical Deus Caritas Est. Also, he wrote to the German Chancellor soon after her election, Angela Merkel, writing to her to lead a European campaign to aid Africa. Charity, almsgiving, giving is really a theme that has been running through this pontificate.
Yes, absolutely. And I think he very much links the support for Christians who suffer for their faith with the whole exercise of almsgiving. That the two are necessarily linked again and again, both in that message that he made to Angela Merkel and even in his Deus Caritas Est encyclical, you can see how he linked theological hope with a practical application. To be ambassadors of Christ, we have to not only think our faith, but to act our faith.
I mean, it's quite interesting that this particular message for Lent is he's asking us to emulate Jesus, Jesus' suffering and his giving of himself to others.
Yes, absolutely. There is a sense in which he really does re-evoke in our minds the way in which Christ very personally identifies with the suffering, that they, by their very nature, have this unique bond of love and of fellowship with Christ. And that is such a powerful Lenten image. It reminds us of the message given by our founder, the founder of Aid to the Church in Need, Father Werenfried van Straten, who spoke very, very powerfully of how the abandoned Jesus on the cross is in effect recreated in the suffering church that he experienced, particularly in those early post-war years of Soviet domination in Eastern Europe. So it's a theme that's very closely connected to the statutes, to the theological underpinning of Aid to the Church in Need.
One thing that the Pope has been saying in this message is that we are not the true owners of the goods that we possess. And he's saying, let us try to think less about these worldly things. They are something that God has given us, a richness, a wealth that God has given us that should be shared. Have you seen many people in your work who are actually able to do this, even though they may just have a little bit to share with others?
Yeah. Again and again and again, and I think it's borne out especially in legacy giving. It is astonishing how it would seem that people who have been devoted to Christ all their lives reach that moment as they approach death where they think, hang on a moment, what really matters here? I can't possibly take all these worldly goods with me up into to heaven, please God, that I get there. But no, I want to use it as a means of giving back to others what I have received myself. I think of those occasions where people have clearly, in an act of extraordinary giving, have spoken to us about how Aid to the Church in Need and other charities too remind them of the temporary nature of this life and how in acts of giving we can make love last beyond the grave.
In this message that the Pope is giving Catholics, he's saying the time of Lent, we shouldn't let it just stop there. charity should become a habit in our lives. But sometimes we feel that, you know, our $10 to a charity, what is that really going to do to help a child in Africa? Sometimes we just throw up our hands and give up and say, goodness, I only have $10 to give. It really doesn't seem like it's going to get anywhere or do any good.
And it is understandable, very understandable, that people should feel a sense, at the very least, of despondency, if not despair, when they see that the situation shows no sign of improvement. But I'm very fortunate in my work at Aid to the Church in Need that I actually am able to see the work myself as it is carried out in countries as spread apart as Sudan, Cuba, and Pakistan, and the Middle East, and the churches that are built, the catechisms that are handed out to children, the child's Bibles, likewise, the convents which might have a chapel built for them. I mean, I think particularly about one particular chapel that I visited in Pakistan, where the support given by Aid to the Church in Need following attack on that chapel in southeast Pakistan, you could see that people considered us heroes in their midst, that we had helped with the rebuilding of this chapel and were pledging to give more. And it was that moment where you saw that the unadulterated and uncompromising pleasure and joy of those benefiting that made you really see for yourself the value, and it reinstated your sense of belief and trust in charitable giving, that it really can achieve miraculous things. And I can see this replicated again and again throughout the work. I mean, in Aid to the Church in Need, the facts speak for themselves that the charity undertakes each year an average of more than 5,000 projects, from church building to supporting seminarians to mass stipends for priests. And then you can see that work being carried out in 140 countries or more around the world. You know, if that was to stop tomorrow, you can rightly ask, where would the church be, the church universal that we hold as being an essential characteristic of our sense of church, our sense of the ecclesial body? But I think that actually the media is partly to blame, because it skews the news agenda so that people only tend to focus in on the disaster situation. The good news story inevitably seems to get buried unless it involves a celebrity or something. So I think Lent is by its nature a time for hope and a time for reassessment, where we break out of the usual confines of our mental habits, if you like, and think more positively about how things develop. And at Aid to the Church in Need, you can see how that very positive development is going on and is building up the church and spreading the gospel.
Thanks there to John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need in the UK. The Vatican marks the 25th anniversary of the 1983 promulgation of the new Code of Canon Law. Among the activities remembering this landmark event in church history, a January Congress with more than 700 participants from around the world to examine canon law in the life of the church. While the current Code of Canon Law is the fruit of years of hard work in the years following Vatican Council II, at that time, Pope John XXIII announced he wanted the old 1917 legislative code to be revised to include the doctrinal aspects outlined during the council. But what exactly is canon law? In ancient Greece, a canon, with a K, was a kind of reed, a symbol of power to rule. Thus, canon means to rule or rule of law. And just like a nation has laws, canon law refers to the regulations of the Catholic Church. Just as a state's laws are divided up into articles in a code of law, the Church's legislation is divided into canons. The canons include the rights and obligations of the faithful and the clergy, rules regarding the sacraments, Catholic schools, and bishops' conferences, just to name a few. The Vatican office, responsible for interpreting the canons and ensuring that they're easily understood and up to date with changing times, is the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, I sat down with the Undersecretary of the Council, Monsignor Bernard Hebda, who told me what the office does and why they're celebrating this anniversary of the 1983 Code.
We're commemorating the fact that the Church was able to put together that codification of the laws, and it was really a very long process, and they did that very well. And so we're celebrating, but we're also trying to see where are those areas where the code might need to be developed further, or where are those areas where it's been particularly successful in addressing the issues and realities of the Church today. So it's really an opportunity to look back at what's happened over these last 25 years.
Before 25 years ago, there was another code in existence. So this one that we're celebrating the anniversary of actually replaces an older codex.
Right. In fact, there had been a code of canon law promulgated in 1917. And so from 1917 until really the time of the council, it was seen to be an adequate code of canon law. On the same day that Pope John XXIII called for the Ecumenical Council, he also said there would need to be a revision of the Code of Canon Law. They would go hand in hand. And so really immediately after the Second Vatican Council, the Holy See began the work of revising the 1917 Code of Canon Law, really to reflect the discussions that had taken place at the Second Vatican Council. So you can imagine if it started right after the council and the code wasn't promulgated until 1983, that you have many years of work, really hard work, with different groups working in the different areas of the law. So penal law, sacramental law, the hierarchical ordering of the church, all of those different groups were meeting throughout that period. And finally, they were able to produce what has been the Code of Canon Law that's really regulated the church since 1983 until today.
This is a huge, big, fat red book I'm looking at here, and it says the Code of Canon Law annotated. Explain that.
You'd be giving a commercial to this group because it's the Code of Canon Law with a commentary that was provided by the University of Navarre. And so it's an English language translation because the code itself is, the only official language is Latin. So when we're looking at anything else, it's just a translation that doesn't have official status.
How many laws are there?
Well, there are 1,752 canons, but that's really not the whole extent of the law in the church because there are liturgical laws. There are also special laws that would govern, for example, the causes for canonization, beatification, causes of saints. There also have been some universal laws promulgated after the Code of Canon Law, for example, regulating the Roman Curia with Pastor Bonus, or regulating the conclave for the election of the popes. All of those things would be laws, too, that you wouldn't find in the Code of Canon Law. The other thing that's interesting is that the Code of Canon Law deals only with the universal law of the Church. Now, there's also going to be a particular law. So in each diocese, or really in each country, if there's an episcopal conference, or really even in each religious community, you would find also norms that would have the rank of law.
And they establish them independently of the Vatican?
Exactly, but as specified in the Code of Canon Law. So the code, for example, indicates where the areas that a national episcopal conference is able to legislate. And so, for example, the conference in the United States or in England or in Ireland, they would be able to draft laws in a number of areas, which they would then submit to the Holy See for something called the recognitio. And it really would be an opportunity for the Holy See to acknowledge the fact that the locally promulgated law was in accordance with the universal laws of the church. So even though it happens at a local level, it's always in harmony with the universal law of the church, the code of canon law.
What would canon law be affecting in terms of mission in other countries?
Something as basic, for example, as preparation for the sacrament of matrimony. The code basically is a compilation of norms that deal with the rights and obligations of the Catholic faithful. And one of the areas in which we exercise those rights and are bound by the obligations is in the area of the sacramental life of the church. So, for example, in marriage. The code gives to the Episcopal Conference, for example, the task of coming up with laws for how is it that we prepare people for marriage? How do we make sure that they're free to marry? And so Cardinal Diaz's congregation, for example, would be helping Episcopal conferences to look at those kinds of questions, or something even such as the proper age for confirmation. Also some very practical questions too, you know, when is it that in terms of some economic questions, when is it that permission would be required to sell property? What value, what monetary value would the property have to have before the request would have to be made to the Holy See, for example, for its examination.
But you're talking about religious-owned property.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So if the diocese were going to be selling a church or a seminary or a hospital, all of those kinds of things, even in mission lands, you know, they would all be questions that would really touch on the particular law of that Episcopal conference. Institutes of consecrated life and societies of apostolic life, and that's also an area where the law is very important in regulating all of these institutes. And they've, as the world's changed and perhaps as religious life has changed, there are all kinds of interesting questions about how the code, the 1983 code, has been able to address them. Another interesting area of discussion is something that was really motivated by our Holy Father's encyclical on Deus Caritas Est. Because one of the things that he said is that the law doesn't really address so much the way in which the church enters into the very activity of charity. And so we've asked Cardinal Cordes, who is the president of the Pontifical Council Quorum, to really address some of those questions.
Which, of course, is the council that the Pope uses for charity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Many people have been writing on this since the Pope's encyclical, and it's still an area that's going to be developed. And that's one of the areas where you see that the law of the church is something that's living, that has to continuously develop.
I mean, the first thing that would come to mind is, we want to be sure that the money gets to the people who need it, right?
Already there, you know, there would be some areas in the present code that would deal with that. But in terms of a specific book in the code that deals with that or a specific series of canons, there wouldn't be anything devoted just to the works of charity.
Mm-hmm. What about a dialogue with other Christian churches? Do you have already some insight as to how the code could help in this dialogue?
Well we've seen in general how the law of the church has been helpful in that dialogue, both in the sense of helping others to understand better what the church is. So if you want to see how the church understands herself, if you look at the Code of Canon Law, you can basically see the structure that's there. And so even in an ecumenical dialogue, that could be something that's very helpful. Just as an aside, within the Catholic Church, there are actually two codes of canon law, because there's the code that we're celebrating is the code of the Latin Church, but then there's also a code of canon of the Eastern Churches. And that also offers a very particular bridge with the Orthodox, because there's basically a shared juridical tradition that's there.
Now, this is the Catholic Church's code for Eastern Rite churches.
Exactly. And which was promulgated in 1990, so 7 years after the Code of Canon Law that we're celebrating. But it's even that Code of Canon Law drew very much from the Code of Canon Law for the Latin Church. But it was fascinating that some years after the code was the code for the Eastern churches was promulgated. This pontifical council put out an edition of that Oriental church code with all of the fonts, the sources for the law. And it was received extremely well among the Orthodox churches because it was the first time that that work had been presented of really exploring the sources of law in that whole ambient.
That's interesting. Again, you're talking with somebody who doesn't know much about canon law. Does the Orthodox Church have something similar to our codes of canon law?
Well, really, each Orthodox Church would have their own set of norms. Mm-hmm. And even within the Eastern Catholic Churches, each of those churches has their own set of norms. But together, they share this code of canons of the Eastern Churches. That's the Eastern Catholic Churches share that. But for the Orthodox Churches, they surely would each have norms that they would follow. For example, how do you decide if something is a valid marriage? Or how do you decide if somebody's validly ordained? Or who has a right to receive the sacraments? So those kinds of questions would all be discussed in some manner in the norms of their church.
Does the Code of Canon Law then assist interfaith dialogue with Muslims and Jews, for example, Hindus, Buddhists?
Interesting question. And it's something that is being explored. There was last year, both here in Rome and also in Israel, there were conferences involving experts in canon law and also experts in Jewish law, Talmudic law. And they were looking at parallels in the different systems and even in the question of interpretation of the law, which is something that our council does. So there are some areas where you're able to foster a certain dialogue. But as I had mentioned earlier, one of the things that's probably most helpful about the law and any kind of dialogue about our code of canon law is that it would give somebody who's not familiar with the Catholic Church a fairly clear idea of the structure of the church and also what's at the core of her beliefs.
That's something I keep hearing more and more, that it's so important to know who you are in order to be able to have a dialogue with someone else, and they have to have a clear idea of who you are as well.
Yes, I would agree with that. It's fascinating that the role that canon law plays in that as well, because there was a time in the church where canon law was seen as being somehow contrary to the pastoral nature of the church. So on the one hand, there was pastoral activity, and then there was this book of canon law that didn't have anything to do with that. Now, more and more, there's a great interest in canon law. There is an increased interest in maybe perhaps what you were suggesting and having a clearer vision of the church's structure and who she is.
And a very warm thanks there to Monsignor Bernard Hebda, Undersecretary of the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.